Hello, I'm Kamal Santa Maria. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, Omicron. Does it ever seem to end? Another new coronavirus variant forcing governments to impose travel bans just as economies were starting to recover. We explore what impact Omicron could have on the health of the global economy. Also this week, green hydrogen, hailed as the clean energy of the future, but can it really help end the use of fossil fuels and start to decarbonize economies? And when sport and money collide, you get a fierce bidding war. Why billionaires and broadcasters are betting heavily on the world's richest sport, cricket, in India. So just when you thought things might be getting back to normal, whatever normal now is, and along comes a new variant of COVID-19 throwing everything into disarray again. Now, a big part of the discussion is whether it's the variant or the fear of the variant which has unsettled things so much, but Omicron is a reminder of just how much our economic normalcy relies on the course of this pandemic. Here's what we know about the new variant, first of all. Scientists trying to understand more about it after it was officially labelled by the World Health Organization as a variant of concern, and given that name, Omicron. The general consensus is that Omicron's mutations could make it more infectious and perhaps less responsive to vaccines. It was first detected in South Africa and later identified in some parts of Europe, the US, Japan, Israel, and now many other countries as well. And then came the reaction, and it was fast. Borders were suddenly closed off to passenger travel from southern African countries, which brought a lot of anger, especially as South Africa felt it had done the right thing in alerting the world to the new variant in the first place. Oil prices fell more than 10% as soon as the variant was detected. Stock markets took a hit too and are expected to face weeks of uncertainty as investors closely watch for updates on Omicron. So what comes next largely depends on what scientists discover and how quickly they do so. So what all this means is that we're back into the realms of one step forward, two steps back. In fact, we arguably already were. Before Omicron emerged, consumer demand was rising. It was good. Economies had reopened. People were back out shopping regularly, particularly with the end-of-year holidays approaching. But keeping up with that demand was already a problem. There were a lot of backlogs in the global supply chain and curbs in manufacturing hubs, which meant a good old-fashioned bottleneck was slowing everything down. Also, prices have been soaring and inflation rates have increased in many parts of the world. In fact, in September, in the United States, inflation was 5.4%, which was the highest in 13 years. And the travel industry, well, it was starting to recover from its pandemic losses, but the knee-jerk reaction to close borders and restrict international travel, it means the airlines and hospitality industry are in uncertain territory again. And so the focus, and this is part of understanding this new variant, is now on how effective our current vaccines will be against Omicron. Drug makers have given mixed information on that so far. Pfizer-BioNTech is upbeat about it protecting against severe COVID. Moderna's not so sure. And of course, there's still the problem of the huge disparities in vaccination rates around the globe. It's estimated around 2% of people in low-income countries have received even just their first COVID-19 shot. So let's try to get some answers. In London, Gregor Owen is with us. He is the Director and Chief Economist at the Strategic Advisory Group Global Council. Gregor, thanks for your time. A little bit of retrospect, first of all, now that we've had a bit of time since the Omicron variant was first announced. What do you make of those market and oil reactions that we saw? I mean, oil fell off a cliff pretty quickly. Markets were all over the shop as well. I mean, is that just the uncertainty, the fact that we just didn't know what we were really dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, we've only had a few days to begin to get our head around the epidemiology of Omicron, let alone the economic impact of it. So I think at the moment, the economic impact is really highly uncertain, and it will be at least a few weeks before we know how big a deal it is in terms of its public health consequences, and therefore what sort of impact it may have economically. Markets are reacting in a perfectly natural way in those circumstances. They're volatile. That reflects the uncertainty that we've seen. Mm.
As ever, it is about balance, isn't it? I'm talking about the idea of looking after people's health, obviously, but of lockdowns and travel restrictions and all these types of things. You would hope by this stage of the pandemic that we would have learnt how this works now, and that maybe immediate shutdowns and lockdowns like that aren't the best way to go.
Oh, I think governments around the world have learned an incredible amount about the right way to introduce public health measures, how to communicate them, what their economic impact is likely to be, and how to calibrate the response appropriately in different circumstances. I mean, it's complicated by politics. Make no mistake about that. Politics gets in the way of good policymaking sometimes. I think what we've seen so far in response to Omicron is, you know, governments, the most restrictive measures that we've seen so far have been on the travel sector. Mm. I think that makes sense. But governments are also really they're really carefully focused on the messaging around Omicron. I think they're worried about some of the behavioural impacts, and that is why the messaging is being quite nuanced so far. And I think we'll continue to see that until we get hard evidence of what the public health implications of it are, and therefore we begin to see what sort of restrictions may or may not be required by governments.
Let's fold some other elements in then. Supply chain problems, inflation as well. Even if Omicron turns out to be not as bad as we think, there's still a number of other things which are holding the economies back.
Yes. So, I mean, supply chain problems remain quite severe. They're causing, you know, considerable logistical problems in a number of different sectors. At the same time, you know, if you think about what the impact of COVID has been on demand, it shifted demand away from services and towards the goods sector. And then on top of that, we've had labour shortages in some markets for reasons that are still being debated. Now, all of this is putting pressure on, I think, goods prices in particular. Goods price inflation has been much more, it's been much higher than consumer services inflation in a number of different markets. Omicron is going to add to that, probably for a couple of reasons. First of all, because central banks are expecting a rebalancing of demand away from goods towards services, and that may well be delayed. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we could actually see, you know, some more disruption to specific nodes and complex supply chains that's going to exacerbate problems there. And I think all of that means that it's just going to take more time for the knots in supply chains to become disentangled. So this combination of supply chain disruption feeding into inflation, I think it's going to cause headaches for central banks for some time to come.
Oh, goodness me. And then to take a step back even from the supply chain, the supply itself, the manufacturing, there were already some limitations, again, COVID-related, on manufacturing hubs, places like China, for example. Is that a concern that the stuff won't be there? Or, as you've said, maybe there's going to be this rebalance away from goods and back towards services?
Well, obviously supply chain disruption feeds into disruption of manufacturing processes. We've seen that impacting most dramatically on those manufacturing sectors that are most sensitive to supply chain disruption, so the auto manufacturing sector and disruption to semiconductor supply, that sector has been particularly badly affected. I think China's interesting for a number of reasons. One is China, you know, just putting Omicron to one side, China has a challenge in the months ahead, which is how to exit from the pandemic if at some point, you know, the world does exit from at least this phase of the pandemic. China's got a zero COVID policy at the moment. How you exit from that and begin to open up China to the rest of the world in terms of, you know, foreign travel and the rest of it, it's not clear how that's going to happen. I think Omicron might delay the moment, the time when difficult decisions need to be taken, but it will actually probably make those decisions even more difficult when eventually they do need to be taken, because the sort of acquired immunity of the Chinese population will be lower and the public health challenges greater. So, you know, manufacturing disruption in China, I suspect we may not have seen the last or even perhaps the most severe elements of that as part of this pandemic.
Gregor Owen, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Let's talk climate now, and as the global crisis escalates, the world is banking on green energy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Thing is, wind turbines and solar panels can't clean up everything, and our cars, trucks, planes, they all require a lot more energy than those sources can provide. But some say there could be a silver bullet in the form of hydrogen, Earth's most abundant element, and it's a clean burner. There are, in fact, three types. Grey hydrogen is extracted from natural gas, so it's the most commonly used form of hydrogen, but it emits a lot of carbon dioxide, so that's not great. If you capture carbon dioxide, though, and store it safely, it's called blue hydrogen. So that sounds better, but it emits a lot of methane, which is also not great. And so green hydrogen, that is generated by splitting the two components of water, oxygen and hydrogen, with an electric current that's powered fully by renewable sources. So, given that simple chemistry involved, green hydrogen could really help us reach zero emissions, that is, the point where we remove as much greenhouse gas from the atmosphere as we emit. Meeting the ambitious plans being made for green hydrogen, though, means building a whole new industry. There isn't enough renewable energy to produce large amounts of green hydrogen in many places. And the machines used to carry out that electrolysis process are expensive. And the gas could cost up to almost $5 a kilogram to make, when really it needs to be below a dollar to be competitive. That said, we are seeing some movement. The European Union is among the biggest investors in green hydrogen. It's planning to build equipment capable of generating 40 gigawatts of renewable electricity into hydrogen by the year 2030. The United States, Saudi Arabia, China and South Africa are also exploring ways to produce it. According to Bank of America, the whole hydrogen market is expected to be worth $11 trillion by the year 2050. But already there are companies trying to get more hydrogen energy out there. One of them is the Australian mining company Fortescue Metals Group, which has plans to produce 15 million tonnes a year of green hydrogen in 10 years from now. And I'm very pleased to say the chairman of Fortescue, Andrew Forrest, is with us now from Sydney. Thank you for your time, Mr. Forrest. We've just done a little bit of an explainer for our viewers about the different types of hydrogen, the green, the blue and the grey. It seems that at the moment, most of it is grey, and that's not great because of its polluting element, and blue's not great on that front either. So is there any point in going down those paths? Should we just be focusing solely on the green?
I think we should focus solely on green. Blue and grey have really had their day in the sun. Grey pollutes about 15 times per unit carbon than it ever produces hydrogen. Blue, we don't know if it's much better. We think it's probably around 12 to 16. But what we do know is most blue will come from methane or LNG, as it's called in the popular sense. But LNG is just methane. That's 80 to 90 times more dangerous as a global warming agent than carbon itself. So if we're worried about global warming, we'd move straight away from grey. We wouldn't touch blue and we'd go green. Green will be abundant. We can see it very clearly. I've done this before. I've built huge companies and projects from scratch. Mm. I can see this very clearly. This is going to happen.
I've got a feeling, though, green is expensive.
You find anything is expensive at the start. Luckily, for most of your consumers, they're not going to buy the $12,000 microwave when it first came out. They'll probably end up buying the $100 microwave, which is much, much better than the first one which came out. A lot like the computer. It will be initially expensive, but that's going to come more at our cost. By the time we're really in production in the late 2020s, this will be as competitive as any fuel out there, with one great difference. You will not be polluting the planet. You will not be harming the future of your planet or your kids.
So let's talk about what you've got plans for. We mentioned the numbers before. I think it was 15 million a year by 10 years from now. And also this plan to build what would be the world's largest electrolyzer, if I'm saying that correctly. Tell us a little bit about that and what that will actually mean in an output sense, like what we will get out of that in theory.
We have green hydrogen projects now all over the world, in every major precinct of our little planet. We're prepared, though, to be very confident, as good as guarantee, the 15 million tonnes from our own country. We know it best. There's huge upside with every other country, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, Europe, etc. But from our own country, we can be assured of it. So the first 15 million tonnes is likely to come from Australia with then top-up supplies. We grow towards 50 million tonnes. Now, specifically, I can share with you that that tonnage is on its way.
Good. That's good to hear. My very simple question for the day is, and forgive my ignorance here, is it like oil and gas? Can you ship it? Is it cost-effective as well to move it around?
Right now, you would containerise it. I mean, any highway you drive down, you'll probably be passing a green ammonia or green hydrogen truck. So it's very common. We've been sending it up into space for 50 years. Sending it across the oceans would be in containers initially, but we're going up for tender in the coming year for green hydrogen ships and green ammonia ships with all the major shipping players. We know that for a green hydrogen perspective, they're going to crack that nut just like they cracked the methane or LNG nut. So we know it's going to be done, but in any event, to the world shipping industry or all those who need ammonia, that 15 million tonnes would supply 70 to 80 million tonnes of green ammonia, which will power the shipping industry, power coal-fired power plants, which can drop by 50% immediately, replace it with green ammonia. So there's a huge demand already for those hydrogen molecules as ammonia. But we won't stop there. We're determined to also ship our customers hydrogen because they need green hydrogen as well as green ammonia.
So you're doing all this at a corporate level, and as you say, you've built previous things from scratch before. How important is it that governments get on board? I know the European Union is one which has said very much, yes, we are committed to this idea. Is the Australian government? Are there others out there?
I think it's absolutely critical governments get on board. There's no force powerful enough now. I'm a major philanthropist. Philanthropy will never cut this. It's just not sustainable. You need a fully sustainable, therefore business-like approach to the end of global warming, a approach which is so large that it can actually bring the warming of our planet to an end over time. That will need to be sustaining. Now, that is, of course, the power of business, the power of commerce. That empowerment will only happen if the governments get on board. You cannot wash your hands and say, well, business will fix everything, because actually businesses like mine got us into this. Businesses like mine must get us out.
It would seem, I mean, we were all focused on COP26 not long ago, that this is the kind of thing which governments could easily get behind. Because, as you say, if you're looking for actual solutions, then, well, it's there and not ready to go, but the planning is already there.
Kamal, this is a practical, implementable solution for the world's energy and green energy product requirements. It can do fertiliser, it can do steel, it can do cement, it can do mobility, it can do fixed plant. We just need to get in behind green hydrogen. People have said to me, oh, look, it's been around for a while. I remind them that it took 100 years for the steam engine to actually get into a train, which revolutionised transport. Yes, hydrogen has been around for a while, but now its day has come. And why not? It's the most abundant element in the universe. It will never run out. We make it with green energy only, not anything to do with carbon, like carbon fuels. We make it with green energy. We now have a permanent supply of pollution-free fuel. We owe that to ourselves, we owe that to our planet, and we owe that to our kids.
Andrew Forrest, great to talk to you, and good luck with things.
Thank you, Kamal.
Finally this week, my favourite sport, cricket. And if I'd been any good at it when I was younger, then now in 2021 I'd be part of something huge, especially in India, where it is without question the most popular sport and now the richest. The Indian Premier League now has an estimated brand value of $6.8 billion. It attracts millions of viewers worldwide. And so broadcasters are bidding high for the rights to stream the matches after two franchises were sold for a combined $1.7 billion. The new broadcast contract starts in 2023. It covers the following 5 years and is expected to bring the Indian Cricket Board up to $5 billion. Even Facebook's thrown its hat in the ring, especially with the IPL expanding to a 10-team season next year with 74 matches. That is 74 opportunities to make some mega money. Look at this from Duff and Phelps, a financial consultancy which produces an IPL brand valuation report each year. The broadcasting fees per match last year were in the realm of $8 million, not that much less than both the English Premier League football and American Major League Baseball, and higher than the German Football League, the Bundesliga, and the NBA. It's all ridiculous amounts of money, quite frankly, so we've got Simon Chadwick with us to help understand it. Simon is the director of the Centre for the Eurasian Sport Industry. He's joining us from Coventry in the UK. Simon, good to see you as always. Can I make a grand sweeping statement to start with and say that sport is not about sport anymore? It's about not just money, it's about broadcasting rights. This is the centre of it all.
I think sport is about a lot of things, not just about sport and money, but about politics as well. It's interesting because we talk about broadcasting, and I think increasingly we need to talk less about broadcasting and more about content generation. And that really is where sport is, I think, beginning to boom, not just cricket, but I think across the world in so many ways, because essentially for over-the-top platforms like Netflix, for example, for Amazon and many others, sport is a way of filling schedules. It's a way of filling airtime. It's a way of generating content for people to access on their TVs, on their mobile devices, on their tablets and so forth. And so there is a intense optimism and a great deal of speculation about the financial windfalls that the future will bring. And so I think what we're doing is we're seeing not just traditional media companies and broadcasters entering the industry, but lots of new players as well. Because I think there is this view that over the next 10 years, what we're going to see is sport being really one of the main drivers of the development of these over-the-top platforms.
Okay, so if we're talking about content, if we talk about the IPL as content, what is it that makes it attractive? Obviously, it's cricket, it's the best players in the world, it's India where there is a huge audience anyway. How is it all packaged up into something which is becoming so attractive and that broadcasters want to pay so much for?
I think one of the things you've got to keep in mind is that broadcasters, over-the-top platforms and others who are involved in any sport need to know that the sport is going to be watched, that it's popular, that people will buy what's on offer. The crucial thing about India is it will very soon be the biggest country in the world. What we've also seen in India is going back 10, 15 years is really quite daring and courageous development of the game that I think in many ways has changed the world beyond, changed cricket beyond recognition across the world over the last decade. And that is this short format game, because many of us are time impoverished. You know, we lead busy lives. We've got kids to look after. We've got jobs to go to. We've got other things to do. So we need our sport bundled up into really easily consumable bits. And what IPL has done is to provide us with something that is very easy to consume, that really retains the essence of what good sport is all about, which is uncertainty of outcome. So there isn't the domination by just one team. There are several teams always that can win. And that leads to a product that is engaging. It's exciting. People draw drama from it. They see it as tense. And so in that way, it's a great product. It's easy to sell and people are engaging with it.
The other side of things where the IPL is concerned is not just the broadcast side, but the actual teams. There are going to be two new franchises and there's a lot of money being thrown around to get the licenses for those. I believe even the Glazer family, who own Manchester United, have shown some interest as well. Is this the other sort of side of it that, you know, if you've got a lot of money, then owning a team is kind of the new thing or an important thing?
One of the things about the global market for sport is that there is a lot of sport and there is increasingly a lot of competition. And so if you want to either improve or even just maintain your position in the industry, you have to spend to survive. You have to invest in new technology, new formats. You have to enter new markets and so on and so forth. And I think, again, that's what we're seeing. But I think certainly in terms of the Glazers, this is a very interesting move. And for the Glazers themselves, they are sports entrepreneurs. They spend money buying clubs and franchises around the world. So in one sense, their investment or their attempted investment into the IPL is testament to the power of the IPL and the commercial returns that can be achieved. But I think the other thing about the Glazers is that clearly they're from the United States. And what we're now beginning to see in the United States is really, there's something bubbling up. Cricket is simmering in the US and what we're seeing is investment within the United States in cricket, in the creation of leagues, in the creation of competitions. And this, for me, is a really, really significant move because the US remains the largest market for sport in the world, you know, maybe somewhere between 30 and 40% of global industry size. So there's money there from TV, from sponsors, from audiences and so forth. But crucially, I think in the United States, we also have a very large Indian diaspora. Mm. And what I sense is it's that Indian diaspora in the United States that is really driving this forward at the moment.
Cricket in America. Who would have ever thought? Hey, Simon Chadwick, always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this week. But I want to know what you think. What do you want to see on the show in the future? Tweet or DM me at KamalAJE. If you are tweeting, use the hashtag AJCTC. Or if email's more your thing, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. And there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Kamal Santamaria. From the whole team, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.